Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TF Blockchain Podcast, where we interview blockchain and digital currency innovators building our distributed future. I'm your host and founder of TF Blockchain, Jonathan G. Blanco. TF Blockchain hosts premier conferences, events, and media featuring blockchain leaders actively growing the industry. With our platform, we are connecting business and technology executives with blockchain innovators leading the charge. Through our interactive speaker presentations, facilitated networking sessions, and our video and podcast series. Before we get started, wanted to tell you about our consulting arm, TF Agency, where we work with blockchain companies, companies looking to adopt the technology, entrepreneurs and investors looking to understand the space, and with those looking to grow their career in this emerging industry. For more information, please email us at info@tfagency.io. So with that, I'm really excited to introduce you all to Sean Shea. I've known Sean for a little over a year now. He's been doing some really interesting things in the blockchain space. This is actually part of our TF product management conversation that we'll be doing with our fireside chat, and we'll talk a little bit about how he sold his last company as the chief product officer, and now he's building a blockchain company as a CEO. So with that, please welcome Sean Shea.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to apologize up front. I do curse, so this is probably going to go to the podcast. Someone's going to have to do some editing.
It's okay. Okay. We'll allow it. We'll allow it. Or we'll do the little the beep noise. Beep.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for being here on this beautiful day. I'd love if you just give a quick intro about yourself, not necessarily what you're doing now, but like, you know, where was Sean born? Just, no, yeah. I'm just kidding. Wait, take us through the origins.
Yeah. Born out of my mom. So I grew up in California in a pretty small college town. Tech has always been a huge part of me. I grew up in one of those cities where, like, you don't know what to do when you come out of school or, like, you know, after you're done with class. And so I think I spent a lot of time in tech, random tech. I don't know if you guys remember like mini disk systems, but you know, I ran a website, like a mini disk community website. I started importing and selling them here in the United States. I got really into graphing calculators for some reason. I don't know why. Started doing assembly programming for all the TI calculators to like build a graphing calculator community on the internet.
So I just used to spell things with numbers
like that you were 8008.
Yeah, yeah. Or things like at a very young and immature age. But you were actually programming in those graphic calculators.
Yeah, but I was just trying to program games. Like, I mean, it was a way for me to like be in class and play with games. But yeah, I think my first foray in technology, just, you know, I kind of developed a really strong love for tech as a young kid. So went to college at University of California, Irvine. That's where I got my computer science degree. Met my first set of co-founders there while we went to school. And we started FlowRoute the first year we came out.
Yeah, so take me through that. So, you know, you meet these friends and, you know, you're probably doing college things and tech things. And then how did you get to like, hey, guys, we should start a company together. We should start working on something.
I think we've, like, me and my co-founders at the time had always been working through college, like random different projects and everything. And the big aha moment for me personally was like I was in my last year of school helping out with a creative agency. They had two startups, and they're pretty sizable deals. So both of them were like multi-million dollar contracts that we had. And it got to the point where I realized that I was kind of the creative director, also the lead engineer on it, and then helped them figure out how to distribute, you know, and they're both internet TV networks at the time.
As a senior in college?
Yeah. And then I realized, you know what, I'm working like 90-hour weeks. I should probably do this for myself and give it a shot. My co-founders, they had also been working for another telecommunications startup at the time and kind of had the same feeling of maybe we should just kind of branch off and do this. So
did the friendship arise from all being in telecommunications, or you just all happened to be working in telecommunications?
No, we started our friendships in college. Like first day of classes when I met one of my co-founders, Brian, and then Jordan, I met him like second year in computer science. And so we just got to watch each other work different jobs and go through different projects. In fact, we did a few, you know, school projects together. So we already had a little bit of a pattern and an understanding of how to work with each other.
Cool. So, okay, so you think about, hey, we should do this for ourselves. How did you start thinking about the product? When did the product ideation come to the forefront and start realizing that, hey, you have something that you could work on here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think back then, there was no concept of product. This was like 2006, 2007, like era, right? Web 2.0 was the hot term, and that was just starting to come to light. JavaScript was starting to get a little bit of attention because you could do crazy things in your browsers. And so back then, I think for us, it was just around what sort of like business are we looking to build?
Yeah.
You got three college guys, none of us with real sort of corporate experience, realizing that we don't have the skills to really be a marketing team or a sales team or whatever. So we just said, okay, what are we? We're computer scientists, so screw it, automate everything. So at that point, the product really became, how do we build a telecommunications product where everything's automated? Onboarding of customers, letting them manage all their services, and on top of that, figure out all their payments. Like, it was just three guys, right? So it's like, we had to figure out how to scale, and the only way that business would exist is if we figured out how to scale out of our own current stage.
Yeah.
So that was a huge, I think a huge like philosophical approach that we took in terms of thinking about the product. But then all
three of us. So it wasn't necessarily like, it's not like you were working for a customer or something like that. You're just like, hey, this needs to be automated. This is crazy.
Yeah. So I'll tell you where the concept of Flowrat kind of spun out from.
Yeah.
We thought it'd be cool originally to not build Flowrat. We thought it'd be really cool to build like a secure telecommunications product. And that was just, you know, you can get a whole bunch of like celebrities or, you know, politicians to have, you know, totally secure telephone lines over the internet. So we were just focused on voice over IP. And we realized, okay, like that's cool. You can use security protocols to kind of like, you know, make sure the lines are good, but you still need to obfuscate the traffic. So we're like, okay, in order to do that, we should probably build a telephone network and, you know, get a whole bunch of traffic on there so we can run our, you know, private telephone calls through that. So in doing that, we, you know, the pursuit of trying to get traffic actually turned into what looked more like a growth, what they term growth hacking today. So we had the goal of like, let's get, you know, a few million users on here just so we can hide our private telephones on this network. And it ended up being, it turned into a real business pretty quick.
So just walk me through that, because why would you hide your private telephones on there with a is that just the threshold you need to be at to do so, or?
It was just around obfuscation of packets.
Got it.
So like, you know, I think it's really easy to pinpoint just, oh, look, there's this secure telephone line, you know, in terms of like media packets transmitting through our network, and that's all it is, versus we can't even pinpoint what's really going on because there are so many telephone calls in this network.
Got it. Okay, so it's three guys, and when do you start realizing that you have a company or that you have a product that, you know, people want to use, and at what point does that happen?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, looking back, I would say we had a company probably a few months in because we had paying customers, we were profitable, and we were growing. We weren't paying ourselves. Like the way we paid ourselves was through pizzas and burritos. But I think after the first year, we decided, you know, we're turning into grown men. Like at the middle age of 20, we should probably get a paycheck.
This is middle age 20.
Middle age of 20.
Yeah.
Throw in those. You know, it's like quarter life crisis is a thing now. So
for sure,
you can throw that in there. But yeah, I think that, you know, looking back, that's when I realized we have something here. But when we were still in it, like everything was kind of a haze. So I was really scared of feeling like we had something real, probably until year two, year three. And it wasn't until we were doing over a few million dollars of revenue on an annual basis where I felt like, oh, we have a real company.
Yeah. So, you know, let's get to that product side of things. So, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of work that needs to be done on that product side. You were leading the product aspect of it. When did you bring on your first product hire? How far into the company?
We actually didn't have a product practice, like from the original start of Flowrat. I would say that the three of us, like co-founders at the time, we're all pretty product inclined in terms of different areas. So
definitely,
I think
from like the founder perspective, right? Like you have to be
thinking about all that stuff. And I would say that we turned product into formal practice in 2015.
Yeah.
So probably
what, what led to that? I have an assumption, but usually what happens is founders just can't keep up anymore with like the product needs, right? And then you just, you need to kind of start really making sure you're doing the practice, doing the documenting, doing those sort of things.
Yeah, I think we got away with it so long. It was just like this Band-Aid that we just kept reapplying. And you're right, I think at a certain point in time, we, as we were scaling up the business, we had roughly around, I think, 25 employees at the time. And then a few of the execs that we'd hired was like, man, you guys need to figure out this product thing. Like, we are hurting here, and whether it's in marketing and engineering or whatever it might be. And like, we just looked at each other with this blank stare, like, what is this product thing that you're talking about? You know, like, we've been getting by fine.
For sure. What, and it's not like you don't learn product management at school. Mm-hmm. You know, you typically learn it, you know, through doing it, through that. So you're, I'm sure you're doing lots of product things without even realizing that you were doing product, right?
Yeah. I think once you start, you know, looking things up on Wikipedia and
you're like, oh, I've been
product?
Doing that.
Yeah. You're like, oh, okay. Yeah, I can check off some of these responsibilities. We built into formal practice though, 2015, and we started building our internal team of like product, during that time. And so, we hired from within, so pulled someone from the marketing department that had an art background, so they kind of fit naturally into the UI UX component of things, pulled someone in from support that was kind of running operations, and then pulled them in because they already had the relationships with customers. And so we felt like that was really critical to just kind of have the same name that people have been dealing with to then have them start to organize, you know, customers' thoughts and really start to prioritize things.
Yeah. And when did it start becoming that discipline, and when did the founders actually start to remove themselves from product, or were they always, did founders always stay involved with product?
I think at our company, we always kept the founders involved in product. I think it's funny when you have people that are super used to doing something in a specific way, and then you start taking away like bits and pieces. It took some time for the change. But at the end of the day, we found something where, we called it like the product council, and it really was sort of like the meeting of the execs, the people that had, you know, different types of business initiatives that they wanted to try to run, and then we just had to organize and prioritize it together as a team, and then from there that would kind of spill down through the organization in terms of how we would prioritize things in the product.
Yeah, so this product council sounds interesting. How did you protect yourselves against getting into like a product management by committee in that process?
We just said customers first.
Yeah.
I think it was, if we ever had a disagreement in terms of priorities, it'd be easy. It would just be like, okay, well, let's go take a look at the system where customers are, you know, whining about this, or they want to see this. And from there, it was just clear as day. Like, you could make your decision. There's some times where we'd have to trumpet, you know, based on other things that were not yet released, that were not yet public. But for the most part, it was all about just paying attention to what customers want and staying in tune with the conversations.
Yeah. So you continue to grow, you're serving the customer, and then you start realizing like, hey, we have a business that could be purchased or be acquired. I'd love to understand how the company, how your co-founder started to think about the existing product that you had and getting it ready for acquisition. And what I mean by that is that, did you start changing your product? Did you stay true to your original product vision? Did you morph it to fit with the needs of a potential acquirer? How did that process start to unravel?
Yeah, I think we made full circle in that process. I think at the time it was like, chase the shiny, and what are people excited about? What are getting the crazy multiples right now? At the time, if you guys aren't familiar with telecommunications, like FloRoute did SIP trunking, which is effectively, you know, you can plug in your server system and then send your phone calls over our network, and we'd pass that through texting phone calls. So at the time, Twilio was preparing to go public, and so everyone was super geeked out over Twilio. There's programmatic communications, here are all the things you can do. So we went through this natural journey of like, who are we compared to Twilio? And through that, we made full circle, meaning we came back and then realized that actually our core product and service was what made our customers really sticky and what made us desirable from our larger customer standpoint in terms of integration into their own network, because we weren't Twilio. So it took about like a solid year for us to figure that out. But then once we did, we just really, really went for that story. And that's how we pitched ourselves too. we started finding other opportunities where we really didn't highlight our own product before, but then we started going, okay, if we can build features around this, we can turn these into sub-products and then make that something that's like desirable from an acquisition standpoint.
For sure. And then did you begin soliciting those, or did people come up to you, or people meaning companies coming up to you? How did those phone calls kind of start to develop?
Well, I would say that that stuff is, it doesn't magically land on your lap. So we built in like an actual deal team internally. This was a really hard conversation because you couldn't really talk to your employees about it during that time. So it just felt like we went to like this super stealth mode of this like this private group that would meet up. We had investment bankers that would help out with this too. And so they kind of had their own list of people they would reach out to, and we would spend time. It felt like you're pitching a raise, but you're pitching a sell. And now I've had the the opportunity to do both. I realized that the selling portion was actually quite a bit harder than actually raising funds for a company.
Yeah, and why is that?
It boiled down to what people were looking for in the end. So when I say it's harder, the due diligence process, like just to put in perspective, it took us about 9 months to get the company sold from like the first conversation of like, here we signed an agreement with investment bankers to getting it done. And we had probably around 12 people internally on our deal team. And then when we got into due diligence, there were 60 people on the other side. So there's just way more players. Now, raising money for Concrete today was conversations with venture capitalists, them meeting us and then identifying us. And I think particularly at the stage that we're raising money for, just going, you know, do they feel comfortable with us as entrepreneurs? You know, I heard from them later on that it was less about the idea, but more about the team. And so I look back and I'm like, man, we maybe had like 5-6 conversations with the VC prior to the negotiations, but then these other companies that were looking to like, you know, they to actually acquire us, that we went so much deeper. I mean, I spent months talking with their different engineering teams, IT teams, different departments around how our product worked, because they would have to actually figure out integration into their own company too.
Right.
Like it was like you're buying something to plug into your own organization.
Totally. And it needs to fit that need.
Yeah.
So company gets acquired. Did you have an earnout where you had to work for the company for a little while?
We lucked out. None of the founders had golden handcuffs. It was really irregular. And then it was also, I can say it now, we're past the time, but it was an all cash deal.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So what was that like, you think, for the employees when they transitioned to the new company? Did they continue to work on FlowRoute as it was, or now it's all about integrating into the product of the acquirer?
I wasn't really around for the full integration and transition. I'm still friends with a few of the people that stuck around and are still there. And so I got to hear multiple sides of the story. I definitely think there were departments and groups that were super focused on like, how do we integrate this right now? Because that was the immediate need. And then we had other people that were just building the product and going, let's continue evolving this thing based on like whatever strategic roadmap we have at that time.
Yeah. Cool. So let's fast forward. So now you're the founder of Concrete. You're the CEO. What's that process been like from, you know, you're exiting before, leading through a product. Now you're the CEO. You're running the product still as CEO.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I kind of classify myself as a product CEO, and there's a lot of different types of leaders out there, and they all have their strengths. We all have our weaknesses. But I think as a startup founder, you kind of naturally need to be very product focused, at least have a love for product to a certain extent. You may not need to be like the product guy in the future. But I think like working in product at FlowRoute and kind of helping the company scale to a certain point, gave me a lot of the experience I needed to step into this role that I'm in right now. Frankly speaking, I kind of feel like I'm doing the same thing, but
totally.
There's just a lot less people, right? And so it's when I say, hey, we need to do this, I realize, okay, I'm signing myself up for this tonight. And it's like, okay, there goes my evening, or there goes next week. So it's, you know, I would say the experience is helpful, but I'd also say stepping into the CEO role, I'm learning so much about myself and where my shortcomings are too. Yeah. So it's been super humbling.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, because ultimately product, more than anything, is just a way of thinking, right? It's like the way you formulate, break down problems and start doing that, that it ties very well to being a founder because you're trying to solve and help your customer. Tell us real quick, what is Concrete? What are you guys building for those that aren't familiar with it?
Yeah, so high level, we're a micro-investing application that allows everyday investors to invest in commercial real estate for as little as a dollar. We are different because we're not just because we're leveraging blockchain tech, but because we're also baking in liquidity into how we operate our investment services. So the traditional construct of commercial real estate is, okay, here's my money, I put it in, and I'll see it in like 7 to 10 years when I exit, or maybe you get in more short-term funds. But the way that we're constructing everything is so that people can enter and exit as they want to. So we actually view our real competitors as high-yield savings accounts. And so when we actually talk about our marketing materials, if you go to our website at concrete.com, you actually see that we compare a lot around, you know, what a savings account is like, what you get out of it, and then what you're getting out of our platform and product.
Nice, nice. And so how do you think you might start to build this company from the product stance? You know, so right now you're obviously early and you raised a seed round, right?
Pre-seed
round.
And we're going through a launch this week.
Launch right now. Yeah. So, you know, even with a small team, what are some of the product practices that you put in place to make sure that you're able to accurately and correctly communicate with your team, get people aligned, and keep moving forward towards the goal?
Yeah, I've really, really trimmed down my old processes. Like, I used to be a lot more formal with things in a bigger organization. You know, you kind of have people emailing stuff, and, you know, the artifacts of what you're creating ends up becoming sort of the inspiration for what they do. But it's so visceral and real now. I mean, you got like three dudes sitting next to you. You know, you're working in a room. And so a lot of my product practice now is in a G doc, like we just write bullet points and we talk about it. And I, at this point, like I really try to facilitate the conversation so that I can look around the room and we can all nod our head and go, yeah, we have a pretty good understanding of what that is. Now, I know it's never going to be perfect. We're never going to be 100% like in line with each other. But I think it's more critical that we start doing something, start building something. I think through that usually unearths like, you know, the next 100 questions after that. So it's a combination of like the most simplistic tool and process right now. It's a fine balance of organization with simplicity and then with execution. And I'm super focused and keen on the execution. I feel like if we're using a tool right now that isn't speeding up our execution, it goes out the window.
Yeah. So, you know, you're probably getting, once you do this launch and you get close to your next raise, I'm assuming you're going to start thinking about hiring product folks. What do you think makes an ideal product management employee? And that's probably going to be different than a product management CEO.
I love when people are like really amazing listeners. I think, you know, in order to be a product person, it's not about telling people this is how it's done, this is how it can be better, but listening and not in just, you know, through conversation. But I think one of the things I used to promote a lot was, you know, we're here at Product at FlowRoute. We are the most empathetic people in the company, and we have to be. And if we're not, then we're not doing our job. And empathy to me is something that can be used on so many different levels outside of just like trying to listen to a conversation, understand the customer pain. But I used to encourage all of our product people to actually put ourselves in the day of our customers and really think, what is their day-to-day? Like, what is it like? Do they wake up at 9? Do they go make coffee? Do they have kids? Like, what is that? Because then at that point, like for me, building a product is around the emotional experience that you're putting someone through and then what they leave. So it's that interaction. Like, you know, people touching your product, they'll be playing with it for a few seconds, but it leaves an impression. And if you're not leaving an impression that makes them want to come back to it, then, you know, I feel like as a product person, you know, we probably haven't done our job right.
Yeah. So I have a couple more questions and then we'll open it up for questions from everybody here. Who do you think, you know, we have these amazing founders here in Seattle, people working on some really interesting stuff. You know, you have folks like Jeff Bezos or Amazon folks. You know, who do you think is the best, or who's your favorite, I guess, founder that thinks of things from a product perspective?
Oh, that's a fun one. Right now I totally idolize Elon Musk so much, and I'm sure a lot of people here can be like, that guy's freaking crazy. I mean, one, from just a work ethic standpoint, like he's a freaking machine, and I don't know if it's healthy or not, but I mean, I grew up with tiger parents, so I'm like, yeah, that's cool. I also think he is one of those guys that's not necessarily thinking about what does this product need, but thinking about how is this product going to unfold and change the future. And I think not enough people think about that when they're building products. A lot of people go, cool, here's a problem, this is my solution, and here's your widget, and I move on.
Totally. Like a lot, it's like solving an actual problem today, but it really seems like Elon thinks of what are the problems, 5 years out, 10 years out,
yeah,
and so forth.
And that's something, like we talk a lot about in Concrete too, is like, how does the story unfold after we're done with this piece? And what are the possibilities with it there? And then what change are we looking to make? And so we kind of roll back, we start from that. Like, what is this world that we're living in? Like, how do we want it to look like? What's the shape of it and everything? And how do we build something so it's something along the way? And so even Concrete as it is today and the way that's manifest in the product is only like a single chapter of something that's a multi-chapter roadmap.
Who's someone that is not a product manager? They might be a celebrity, a sports person, but you think does a really good job of thinking through things like a product manager would.
Oh, celebrities, huh?
Okay. Or not necessarily a celebrity, but like, I don't know, Michael Jordan, for instance, is a great example, right? Like, so he has his Jordan brand. He really thinks through products. Sure, it's not a technical aspect. He has obviously a whole crew of folks behind him building these things. Or, you have someone like Kanye West, who, people think is he's a very eccentric person, but he has, these products that he builds, and he treats himself as a product, right, in the way he promotes himself. Who's someone like that that you would think of?
I was thinking about Kanye West just now because I think he does a phenomenal job with sort of the intersection of music, culture, fashion, and he just kind of embodies it, both from like who he is, his own identity, his own brand identity, and then how he applies himself towards building things. But I go back to like my childhood, and I love hip hop music. Jay-Z was a huge sort of like artist that I followed, and his one quote is just like, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. Like, I was just like, man, that sticks in the back of my mind all the time.
For sure.
And it's cool. It's just like, it changes your frame of thought and your approach.
Yeah. Diamonds are forever.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the TF Blockchain Podcast. We appreciate your support as we continue our mission to connect the broader business and technology community with blockchain innovators. For the most up-to-date information on all things TF Blockchain, please visit tfblock.io. Please like and subscribe to our podcast to be the first to hear from our amazing speakers changing the world through blockchain and crypto. If you're interested in partnering with the TF Blockchain Podcast, please email us at podcast@tfblock.io. Be on the lookout for TF Blockchain chapters coming to your city, and please reach out to us if interested in becoming a chapter director. We hope to see you soon at one of our live events. Thanks for listening, and remember, stay crypto, my friends. The views and opinions expressed at TF Blockchain events and podcasts are solely those of the ones presenting and do not necessarily reflect the position or opinion of TF Blockchain. TF Blockchain is not responsible for the opinions or content of its guests and does not endorse any particular company or currency. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be used to make investment decisions.